but hopefully they'll be here soon. Ms. Chin Kaplan, are you about ready to go here? Back on the record here, Dr. Krigsman has taken the witness stand. Dr. Krigsman, would you raise your right hand for me? Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give us will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Okay. Please, both of you, please speak up and go ahead, Ms. Chin Kaplan.
Thank you, Special Master. Could you kindly state your name for the record, please?
Sorry about that. My name is Arthur Krigsman.
Dr. Krigsman, what is your current business address?
290 Central Avenue, Suite 204, Lawrence, New York, 11559.
Are you a physician?
I am.
Do you have a specialty that you practice?
Pediatrics and pediatric gastroenterology.
Could you kindly give a brief description of your educational background for the court?
Starting from undergrad?
From undergrad.
Yeah, I received a Bachelor of Science, graduating with honors at Johns Hopkins University. I went on to medical school at SUNY Downstate in Brooklyn. I was there 4 years. I did a 3-year general pediatric residency at SUNY Downstate / Kings County. It's a combined program. And I did a 3-year fellowship in pediatric gastroenterology after that at Mount Sinai Hospital in Manhattan.
And since that time, have you practiced either pediatrics or gastroenterology?
Yeah, since that time, I practiced general pediatrics up until 2004, maybe actually 2005, early 2005. And at the same time as doing general pediatrics, I practiced pediatric gastroenterology from completion of my fellowship until the present.
And do you have any board certifications?
I'm board certified in general pediatrics and pediatric gastroenterology.
And Doctor, you indicated that you practiced pediatric gastroenterology concurrently with pediatrics.
Correct.
And can you tell us generally where you practice pediatric gastroenterology?
Well, upon finishing my fellowship at Mount Sinai, I practiced pediatric gastroenterology at Beth Israel Hospital in New York, and I was there from 1995 until 2000. My title there was director of the Department of Pediatric Gastroenterology. It was actually a department of one, and that was myself. And I did all the clinic work. I did all the in-house referrals. I oversaw resident teaching. Residents made rounds with me on the pediatric floors and also were with me in the clinic, and as well as teaching pediatric residents. The adult GI fellows were also routinely part of the pediatric gastroenterology clinic services there at Beth Israel. And after 2000, the medical merger wave hit New York, and a number of large hospitals banded together, my understanding is, in an effort to have greater negotiating leverage with reimbursements. But because of that, all the part-time physicians at Beth Israel, those who were not full-time, were released, and they only kept the full-timers, and I was a part-time salaried physician at Beth Israel. So at that point, I left Beth Israel, and Lenox Hill Hospital recruited me. Lenox Hill Hospital in Manhattan recruited me. They called me that, heard you're available, would you come and join us? And I was very happy to do that. And I assumed the same type of position at Lenox Hill Hospital as I had had at Beth Israel, where I oversaw their entire pediatric GI clinic, and I did all their in-house pediatric GI consultations.
How did you become interested in autistic children and enterocolitis that they exhibit?
The first patient I saw with autism and gastrointestinal problems was sometime late in 2000. And I was a member of a pediatric practice, general pediatric practice in Woodbury, New York, with a number of of associates in the practice. And one of them is an allergist. He's a board-certified allergist, as well as a pediatrician. And he had a number of children with autism that he followed within our pediatric practice because he viewed them as having an allergic disorder, and he would do allergy testing and allergy desensitization techniques, either shots or nasal sprays to desensitize them. And he referred me a few of his patients because he was concerned that the parents all said that those kids had this ongoing nasty diarrhea and seemed to have abdominal pain, and something he saw on a number of patients, and he wondered if him and I, working together as associates within the same pediatric practice, if I would be interested in evaluating them from a gastrointestinal standpoint. So I told him that I would. I told him I did not think I would find anything wrong with them, but I'd be happy to do the evaluation, which I did. And those were my first patients.
And what were the clinical indications for a referral to a GI doctor?
Well, the gastrointestinal indications were chronic diarrhea and abdominal pain. That seemed to be going on for many years in these patients that he initially referred to me.
And Dr. Can you just generally describe the workup that you did on this initial group of children?
Well, it's a standard diarrhea workup that, you know, that's sort of the bread and butter of pediatric gastroenterologists. And, you know, you look for causes of diarrhea, you look for dietary causes, you look for the possibility of toddler's diarrhea, you look for infectious diarrhea, you look for any underlying metabolic abnormalities, and most of those, if not all of those possibilities, would be covered by some simple routine blood tests and a careful history and careful physical examination.
And did you do this routine blood work and examination on this initial group of children?
I did.
And did you find anything that would lead you to believe that it was related to this non-invasive type of evaluation?
No, the evaluation, the standard evaluation for diarrhea and abdominal pain, type of diarrhea that these children had, was unremarkable, and I had no answer for these patients, and I told them that I just don't know, and left it at that.
So you didn't they didn't have any infectious sources of their diarrhea?
I'm sorry?
They didn't have any infectious sources of their diarrhea?
No, their stool cultures were negative. While for parasites, these were the routine measures that we would do for a workup to rule out infectious diarrhea.
And you indicated that you took a history of these children?
Correct.
And was there anything in their history that would indicate that their symptoms would be related to dietary foods?
Some of them did. Some of the parents claimed that certain types of foods and would cause worsening of the diarrhea and worsening of the abdominal pain. And most, if not all, of the patients that initially came to me, those first bunch of patients, had already enacted some sort of restrictive diet that they had heard about from their friends or heard about at meetings or conferences. But despite a variety of dietary interventions, both those that were circulating amongst the autism community at the time and also the more standard dietary changes that the pediatric gastroenterologist would put in place to try and determine if this is a toddler's diarrhea or if this was a other forms of innocuous diarrhea, those were all done and they were attempted and didn't result in any improvement. So I really didn't understand why these children had diarrhea.
So what did you do next for these children?
I told them goodbye.
And then what happened?
At that point, well, probably it was sometime in 2001, is how I recall it. I may be off by a few months. In 2001, the doctor who initially referred these patients to me, my associate, showed me an article written by Professor John Walker Smith, amongst others, describing exactly this group of children and that I had seen, but identical histories, meaning they had autism, they had chronic diarrhea, chronic abdominal pain, and they did the workup that I had essentially done. And they had also come up with no diagnosis based upon lab tests, history, and physical exam. And what they did different was they considered the possibility of an inflammatory bowel disease, which I had not considered. When I initially met with these children, the possibility of this being an inflammatory bowel disease of some type didn't enter my mind because the conventional teaching of the specific types of diarrhea that you would have, meaning bloody or even microscopic or grossly visible blood, weight loss, recurring fevers, those symptoms were not present in any of these children. So I didn't entertain that possibility, but the group at the Royal Free did. And they went ahead and performed a colonoscopy, a diagnostic colonoscopy, on a number of these children, and specifically I think it was 62 or 63 children, and they published their results in September of 2000 in the American Journal of Gastroenterology. And what they demonstrated was that the majority of those children who were in fact identical in history, physical examination, and laboratory presentation to the ones that I was seeing, the majority of those children there demonstrated this nonspecific inflammation of the colon and of the very end of the ileum. I was shown that article, and I read it a number of times. And I paid attention to it because I didn't know any of the authors on the article, but the final author, the senior member of the group, the senior investigator, Professor John Walker Smith, is a world-renowned pediatric neurologist. He's very prominent, and it was his textbook that I had actually used in my training to learn pediatric gastroenterology. So he was a name that I recognized, and it made an impression on me because, again, it was exactly what I was seeing in my own office.
Doctor, you indicated that this was an article that your colleague showed you?
Correct.
You yourself did not see this?
No, I did not make the effort to investigate myself.
And you indicated that it was published in the American Journal of Gastroenterology?
That's correct.
And roughly, do you recall the year that it was published?
September of 2000.
September of 2000. So after you reviewed this article, what did you do then?
So at that point, I wondered whether some of those, or all of the patients I had initially seen and didn't think I could help, perhaps had this disease. And what was interesting about, again, just to go back to that article, is that if the diagnosis, in fact, is an enterocolitis, that's something that's treatable. So that was what was so attractive about this finding, is that it offered something to these children that you could do for them to make their quality of life that much better. So I called these folks back and performed a diagnostic colonoscopy on them. And to my great surprise, the pathologists that were reviewing the biopsies that were obtained at those initial colonoscopies were reading the same nonspecific colitis that the pathologist at the Royal Free had read and that had been published. And that was very interesting.
And doctor, at this point in time, did you do colonoscopies on all the patients that you had initially turned away?
I don't remember if it was all of them or how many, you know, were interested in pursuing that. Many of them.
And do you recall of the initial group how many you actually did perform a colonoscopy?
I don't recall the number of the group. I want to say it was 7 or 8 kids that I said I wasn't interested in that, and I can't help you. And I made the effort to call back all of them. I don't remember how many of them mm-hmm. came back and underwent the colonoscopy, but a number of them okay. followed through with it.
And did you continue to perform colonoscopies on these children?
Yeah. So, you know, at that point, we had a very large pediatric practice, and certainly within our own practice, there were many children with autism who had these same gastrointestinal symptoms. And in addition to that, this associate of mine had a separate allergy practice in which he had a lot of children with autism as well. So he would send those patients my way if they had gastrointestinal problems.
Doctor, how many colonoscopies did you perform before you believed that there was some connection between the child's autism and the enterocolitis?
I remember it being after my 22nd patient, and I don't know why that's, you know, when the light went off, but that's, I remember seeing that 22nd pathology report, and you know, virtually all those first 22 showed identical findings, and that's when I concluded that there's probably something going on in the bowels of these kids.
Now, you said that they showed all very similar findings. Could you describe to the court what those findings were that you were seeing?
Well, the findings were both endoscopic. In other words, when you have the colonoscope within the colon, there's a certain a certain appearance that the mucosa, the lining of the bowel, has to the endoscopist, and it's defined in terms of how red or pink it is, pink being healthy color, red being unhealthy. It's defined in terms of ulcerations in the lining of the bowel. It's defined in terms of the degree of vascularity and vascular markings, in terms of the smoothness of the surface. Those are all endoscopic appearances that one can appreciate just visually looking at the mucosa, the lining of the colon. And then beyond that, there's a microscopic appearance of what the pathologist sees when they examine the thin slices of biopsies that are obtained. And the biopsy findings that these children, the majority had, were what would be called either chronic or an active colitis, or both, meaning whether the types of inflammatory cells are lymphocytes, or whether they're neutrophils, or whether they're eosinophils, where they're located, how they're clustered, those all go into determining if this would be labeled as a acute or a chronic colitis. And there are also additional findings such as cryptitis, which is highly characteristic of inflammatory bowel disease, and also other, I shouldn't say just IBD, but cryptitis is a sign of a more advanced invasion of the lining of the bowel and burrowing into the crypts. The colon is full of these small crypts, that's mucus primarily. So cryptitis is a very characteristic finding of the more advanced inflammation, and we saw those as well. And there are a few patients who have what's called the crypt abscess, which is even a more advanced level of colonic inflammation. So this first bunch of patients had varying combinations of these findings.
What did you do after you did these colonoscopies?
After the colonoscopies were done and the biopsies were reviewed by the pathologist, I decided to try treating this enterocolitis. Primarily it was a colitis, and the term colitis, by the way, just to clarify, refers to inflammation of the colon. When I use the term enterocolitis, the term entero refers to involvement of the small intestine as well. So an enteritis would be small bowel inflammation, a colitis it would be colonic inflammation, and enterocolitis would be both inflammation of the small bowel and also of the colon. So when I saw these biopsies that demonstrated enterocolitis, I decided I would treat them with oral anti-inflammatory drugs, the same ones that are very commonly used in inflammatory bowel disease. And that's what I was using at the very beginning. And my observations at that point were that when these patients with biopsy-proven enterocolitis were started on these oral anti-inflammatory drugs, their symptoms markedly improved, meaning their diarrhea markedly improved, and their abdominal pain markedly improved as well.
You indicated that you were treating them with anti-inflammatories. The fact that they responded to the anti-inflammatories, would that be an indication that they were suffering from a form of inflammatory bowel disease?
It indicates that they were suffering from intestinal inflammation. It doesn't prove that it was in and of itself. Taken as an isolated observation, the response to an oral anti-inflammatory drug, the symptomatic response, an improvement in diarrhea, in and of itself doesn't prove that the diagnosis is inflammatory bowel disease. What it does suggest is that there's bowel inflammation that's there, that's being of some type, that's being treated with an anti-inflammatory drug.
Now, at some point in time, did Teresa Cedillo contact you?
Yes, I first met Teresa, as she testified earlier today, at a Dan conference that I had spoken at, and I think it was the October 2002 DAN conference. And I'm not sure. In San Diego. That's where I think it was, though.
And do you recall what she said to you?
She came over to me and introduced herself, and I remember the conversation, only because, you know, the story was a very sad one, and Michelle sounded like a very sick little girl, and I remember hearing some of the details and encouraging her to work with her pediatric gastroenterologist, who she was already associated with locally.
And what was her response to that?
She was happy to do that, and I offered to be available for, you know, to input any experience that I had had dealing with these children.
And did you speak to her local gastroenterologist?
At that point, no. He did not call me. Not immediately. A few months afterwards, I did speak with him on the phone. I don't recall if it was he that called me or I that called him.
Okay. And do you remember what the substance of that conversation was?
We spoke a little bit about my experience with these children and, you know, what I thought might be going on in Michelle's bowel based upon the story that Teresa had told me.
Okay. And at some point in time, did Mrs. Adil contact you about evaluating Michelle?
Yeah, in the middle of 2003, either it was late spring or summer of 2003, she called and she said that Michelle was getting worse, and that she had lost about 20 pounds over the previous 6 months. She wasn't eating, but she was eating. She was vomiting. Her diarrhea had become unmanageable, and she was sick, and she was pale, and she was weak, and she was very concerned. So at that point, she called me to let me know that this was going on.
And did she inquire about whether she could come and see you?
She indicated that she really wanted to come and see me. And what I told her is that that didn't sound like it was a good idea, because Michelle did not sound like someone that should be traveling across the country on an airplane in that condition. So she ended up being hospitalized locally in Yuma. What you heard about this morning, she was hospitalized for dehydration. She had evidence of malnutrition as manifested by a vitamin K deficiency. And she had, at that hospitalization, she had placement of a surgical jejunostomy tube to ensure that she would be able to get the calories that she needed to reverse the malnutrition and the weight loss.
And did Michelle Sedillo eventually come to you for evaluation?
So after she was discharged from that hospital stay in July, August of 2003, she called and she said, you know, we've been discharged and she really would like to come see me. That's what she did.
And when Michelle arrived, did you conduct a physical and an exam of her? Well, what did you do when Michelle came for evaluation?
Well, when she came, the expectation was that she would undergo another diagnostic endoscopy and colonoscopy. And the indication for that endoscopy and colonoscopy was the dramatic worsening of her condition over the previous few months. With a previous endoscopy and colonoscopy in January of 2002, that was essentially normal and didn't explain why she would have this such dramatic worsening of her GI symptoms. So the hope was that now, a year and a half later, a year and three quarters later, there might be some answers that the biopsies or the colonoscopy might show. So that was the expectation, and she came, history, physical exam, and which the history was, again, as you've heard, physical exam, she was a sucky looking girl. She did not look well at all. The next day she underwent a diagnostic endoscopy and colonoscopy.
And what were the results of her colonoscopy and endoscopy?
Well, the endoscopic appearance, so the visual appearance looking through the upper endoscope, was one of this streaking lymphonodularity of the esophagus. She had gastritis, meaning stomach inflammation. She had, and on the colonoscopy, she had the presence of four ulcerations, which are labeled as aphthous, ulcerations, and I want to define that term that slides a bit later on, but she had four aphthous ulcerations of her sigmoid colon that were photographed, and in addition to that, visually, she had marked lymphoid hyperplasia of the terminal ileum. Those were her endoscopic findings. On biopsy, the only finding that was demonstrated was this lymphoid hyperplasia of the ileum.
And after the colonoscopy and the endoscopy, did you come to a conclusion whether Michelle had a condition?
Well, yeah, I concluded based upon her history, based upon the presence of arthritis, which was known at that point, and what appeared to be a uveitis, although it was not yet diagnosed when I saw her, and the appearance of these aphthous lesions of the colon, taken in combination, that's highly suggestive of some form of inflammatory bowel disease. If I had to choose one particular diagnosis at that point, it would be Crohn's disease, but I was hesitant to call it Crohn's at that point because it didn't fit didn't have the diagnostic criteria that would allow me to label it definitively as Crohn's disease then, but I was quite sure that she had a variant of some sort of inflammatory bowel disease.
Doctor, you mentioned inflammatory bowel disease. Are there many inflammatory bowel disease?
Well, the term inflammatory bowel disease is really an umbrella term, and it encompasses a number of different diagnoses. The two primary diagnoses that it encompasses are ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. There are, however, other diagnostic entities such as indeterminate colitis or microscopic colitis that can technically fall under that category. And, you know, those, particularly the indeterminate colitis, is one where the features, the overall presentation, history of the physical examination, is suggestive of either Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, but you don't get the tissue diagnosis or the x-ray diagnosis that allows you to confirm with certainty which one of those two diagnoses it is. And that happens fairly frequently in gastroenterology. And when that happens, when the clinician suspects that it's inflammatory bowel disease, but we are unable to label it definitively as Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, it sort of goes into the category of indeterminate colitis. And many of those patients, over the course of time, it becomes clear which diagnosis they truly have. Is it Crohn's or is it ulcerative colitis or something else?
So what is the distinction between ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease?
There are many. The distinction of them is primarily as follows. In ulcerative colitis, you tend to get inflammation limited to the lining of the colon. It doesn't penetrate deep into the muscular layer of the bowel. So it involves the lining, and it's also contiguous, meaning it begins, the inflammation always begins at the anus, and it extends proximally to varying lengths. And some people can only involve an inch or two of the rectum, starting from the anus. Other people can involve the entire colon. And other people, it involves varying portions of the colon, anywhere in between the entire thing and almost nothing. But it always starts distally at the anus and extends proximally. And there are no skip lesions. You tend to have a contiguous inflammatory pattern. That's a classic definition of ulcerative colitis, as opposed to Crohn's disease, which, number one, can occur anywhere from the mouth to the anus. So unlike ulcerative colitis that occurs only in the colon, perhaps the last inch or so of the ileum, but nothing more proximal than that, the Crohn's disease can occur anywhere from the mouth to the anus, anywhere in the gastrointestinal tract. In addition, Crohn's disease is known to involve not just the interior lining of the bowel, but even deeper layers, and even perforate the bowel and form fistulas or tracts between the bowels and other organs. In addition to that, as opposed to ulcerative colitis, as we just discussed, that's contiguous. Crohn's disease tends to be patchy, so that you can have abnormal areas, diseased areas of bowel that are interspersed with areas that appear normal or that are, and that in fact are normal to all ways that we are testing. So those are the three primary differences between Crohn's and ulcerative colitis.
And you indicated that after Michelle's colonoscopy and endoscopy, that her history of diarrhea, arthritis, or uveitis, and the aphthous ulcers, lesions of the colon that you find were highly suggestive of inflammatory bowel disease, but you hesitated to call it Crohn's. Can you tell the court why you did not believe she could make a definitive diagnosis of Crohn's here?
I hesitated to call it Crohn's because Crohn's disease, if you're a Crohn's purist, you would want specific findings to label it as Crohn's. You would look for, number one, a tissue diagnosis, a biopsy that demonstrated particularly something called a granuloma. Granuloma is a complex of inflammatory tissue that has a very characteristic appearance. On a biopsy, and pathologists are trained to look for that and notify the gastroenterologist when it's present. Most patients with Crohn's disease, you don't find the granuloma at biopsy, but when you do, and the clinical suspicion is high, something that would lead you to conclude that this Crohn's disease. In addition, patients who have strictures or fistulas, those are the classic protean manifestation of Crohn's disease, and Michelle didn't have them. So although she had many other features of inflammatory bowel disease, she had, from a physical exam point, she had this uveitis, she had an arthritis, both of which are known to accompany Crohn's disease. It's well documented and it's well established, and that's beyond dispute. She had them. She had laboratory markers of inflammation, such as the ESR, the erythrocyte sedimentation rate. It's a nonspecific marker of inflammation, so it's not diagnostic of bowel inflammation, but it's certainly expected when you have Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. She had an elevated C-reactive protein, which again is another inflammatory marker that's nonspecific. She had an elevated platelet count known as thrombocytosis, which is also nonspecific. But she had all of those in the presence of uveitis and arthritis and aphthous ulcerations of the bowel with a history of abdominal pain and diarrhea. So that's what made me suspect Crohn's disease, but I was hesitant to label it as Crohn's because I would have liked to see the absolute characteristic and diagnostic features of Crohn's, and in Michelle's case, that was absent. And I should add one more thing. The most impressive lab test of all was an elevated, it's called OMPC, O-M-P-C, OMPC, and it's outer membrane porin C, and this is an antibody that's found in the blood of Crohn's patients. The majority of Crohn's patients do not have anti-OMPC, but the presence of anti-OMPC, the specificity of that lab test. In other words, how many times do you have positive OMPC and in fact don't have Crohn's disease is very small. So on top of all the things I mentioned that made me clinically suspect that this girl had an inflammatory bowel disease, she has an anti-OMPC, which is highly specific for Crohn's disease as well.
And after reviewing all the findings, did you decide on a course of treatment for her?
So once we had the visual confirmation of the aphthous ulcerations, I was satisfied that I was dealing with an inflammatory bowel disease, indeterminate colitis is what I really wanted to call it. And the designation is not that important because the treatment is really the same anyway. So we don't go to extraordinary lengths to confirm a diagnosis with this sort of situation. And those things tend to resolve themselves over time, and the diagnosis ultimately becomes clear. And in Michelle's case, it did, and we'll get to that in just a few minutes, I guess. I decided to treat her with a combination of sulfasalazine, which is an oral anti-inflammatory drug. It acts topically on the lining of the intestine. I treated her with a medicine, with steroid prednisone, which of course is an anti-inflammatory drug. And I also treated her with a medicine called 6-MP, 6-mercaptopurine, which is an immunosuppressant agent. And I chose that combination of drugs based upon the degree of illness that Michelle had, this dramatic weight loss, this inability to tolerate foods by mouth, this necessity for a feeding jejunostomy tube, the uveitis, the arthritis, the horrendous diarrhea, the intensity of all of it, and also the fact that this family was really out in the wilderness of Yuma. All those things made me want to ensure that we got this disease under control very quickly.
And Doctor, you were in New York, and Mrs. Sedillo and her family, Michelle, was living in Arizona. That's a problem treating her long distance.
It's a big problem. It's a testimony to Teresa and her obvious endurance and desire to help her child. I had encouraged her to find someone local that would be able to see Michelle, that would be able to understand the illness, that would be available, that would look at Michelle as having bowel inflammation and treating it. And she made every effort to do that. It took her a while to find the right people. But during the period of time that she was searching, she really didn't have any other available gastroenterologist that was willing to prescribe these medications because they saw the disease the way that I did. So I ended up working very closely with her pediatrician, who was very, very cooperative. And together we managed Michelle in the early part after I had seen her initially.
Now, you indicated that you ordered sulfasalazine, prednisone, and 6-MP. Are those all drugs that are standard in the use of inflammatory bowel disease?
Yes, they are.
And to your knowledge, did Michelle improve on this medication?
Oh yeah, her clinical symptoms improved markedly. So. Her stools, the horrendous diarrhea, which you've heard so much about, I don't recall if it disappeared and they became normal, or if the frequency went down to once a day and became almost normal, but clearly it was not the 8 or 9 liquidy stools anymore. And that was a dramatic quality of life improvement, the pain, the irritability, the crying, the self-abusive behaviors, and also her arthritis, the degree of swelling of the joints. Her ability to ambulate, at least to some extent, all improved.
Now, Dr. Prednisone, is that a drug that a person can remain on long term?
Prednisone, given over the long term, will almost always, if not always, produce toxicities. So prednisone is not a drug that you want to have someone on long term, unless you absolutely have no other choice.
And did you try to wean Michelle off of prednisone?
A number of times we tried to wean her off it. My hope was that because she was on 6-MP, and because she was on sulfasalazine, and because we had started an elemental enteral formula, meaning there's a school of thought in Crohn's disease that one way to treat it is by decreasing the antigenic stimulation to the bowel from dietary factors, so that you give an elemental formula, a formula which is broken down to its elemental parts. There are no complex proteins in the formula to act as antigens. That's one way to treat IBD and Crohn's as well. And we had that going through the J-tube at that time, my hope was that between the enteral feedings, the elemental feedings, the prednisone and the 6-MP, the 6-MP and the sulfasalazine, we would be able to get her off prednisone. We found that whenever we got her below a certain threshold dose, the symptoms returned. So she was demonstrating what we call steroid dependency.
What did you decide to do then when it was clear that she was steroid dependent?
Well, at that point, what you normally try and do is want to maximize the sulfasalazine that a patient gets and maximize the 6-MP. You maximize the non-steroid drugs in the hope that you can eliminate the steroids. Now, with Michelle, when we tried to do that, a lab test called lipase, L-I-P-A-S-E, lipase became elevated. And lipase is most frequently an indicator of pancreatitis. Not exclusively, but when you see an elevated lipase, the first thing you think of is a pancreatitis. 6-MP, one of the known complications of 6-MP, is that it can cause a pancreatitis in many people. And pancreatitis can be a nasty illness. It can become chronic. So I don't recall that we had ever obtained a baseline lipase. No one had ever drawn that particular lab test prior to her starting on 6-MP, but most clinicians, once they start a patient on 6-MP, will monitor the lipase at regular intervals just to make sure that there is no pancreatitis that's forming. So when we did that, we found that Michelle's lipase was markedly elevated. And the immediate and recommended response to that is to discontinue the 6-MP, which is what we did. So now she's off 6-MP, and she's again stuck with the prednisone and the sulfasalazine and the enteral feedings, all the while demonstrating some prednisone toxicity.
What did you do then?
So at that point, is that it was clear that she needed to come off prednisone, yet she needed it to function. The next step in that type of patient is to go to the next class of immunosuppressive drugs. There's a newer class that was introduced about 10 years ago, and it's called anti-TNF, anti-tumor necrosis factor drugs. And TNF is the cytokine. It's a molecule, and it's a product of lymphocytes, and it's a molecule that is particularly active in excess in patients with Crohn's disease. And this drug was developed in the last 10 years or so, maybe 11, 12 years, that acts to block the effects of TNF, so that TNF is not able to stimulate an inflammatory response. And that's again, it's a new class of immunosuppressants, but and it's very effective, very, very effective in those diseases that that involve TNF as the mediator of inflammation. Using an anti-TNF agent is very, very effective in bringing about clinical improvement. And that was the next step for Michelle. The trade-off is that along with its therapeutic efficacy, because its potent immunosuppressive capacities, therein lies the potential for side effects, so that when you immunosuppress a patient too much, you get a whole host of potential side effects. And that, of course, goes into your decision in whether to start this drug or not. Clearly, Michelle was a candidate for this drug because there really was no other choice. And it's widely used. It's a widely used drug. But this is the thinking that clinicians go through before deciding to use it. So at this point, she was at a state where she needed this anti-TNF drug. It's most commonly known as Remicade as a trade name. And so the decision was made to institute Remicade therapy.
And did Michelle respond to the Remicade?
Oh yeah, she did very well with that actually. It markedly improved her diarrhea again, because once the 6-MP was stopped, her diarrhea really became horrendous, and so did her arthritis. When Remicade was begun, I don't recall the exact date that it was started, but when it was begun, it produced, again, this marked improvement in both her diarrhea, her abdominal pain, and the arthritis.
And we've heard testimony that at some point in time, the Remicade had to be stopped. Is that true?
That's correct.
And what was your understanding of why the Remicade had to be stopped?
It was stopped because of the... she had had a seizure. It wasn't her first. It was, you know, one of her many seizures. But this one occurred while she was standing, and she fell. And she sustained a fracture to, I think it was a tibia fibula fracture, I think. And it required immobilization and screws and casting. And you've heard the story from Teresa. And there was concern from the orthopedic surgeon who was responsible for the bone healing that the Remicade may interfere. There's some evidence that Remicade has the potential to interfere with bone healing. And in fact, in Michelle's case, the bone healing took a very long time. The concern was, the intent was to eliminate all the potential confounding factors that might inhibit the healing of that bone. So the Remicade was discontinued.
And Doctor, at some point in time, you had suggested earlier to Mrs. Steele that she get a local gastroenterologist, correct?
Correct.
And at some point in time, did she eventually do so?
Oh yeah.
And did you communicate with that gastroenterologist?
Absolutely.
Do you know who that gastroenterologist was?
The one that Michelle, that Teresa had met with, that she liked, was Dr. Donna Ursaya at Phoenix Children's Hospital.
And to your knowledge, did Dr. Ursaya conduct some additional diagnostic testing of Michelle?
Yes. So Dr. Ursaya wanted to establish a baseline, this is now 2006, of the status of Michelle's bowel disease. And she performed an upper endoscopy, colonoscopy, and also a pill camera study of the small bowel.
You mentioned a pill cam. What is a pill cam?
A pill camera it's exactly what it sounds like. It's a camera. It's the size of a small pill, and it's designed to be swallowed.
And when you swallow the pill, what does it do?
The pill cam does, it takes two photos per second as it traverses its way through the upper gastrointestinal tract. So that the moment you swallow it, you've begun to photograph the esophagus, the stomach, and the small intestine. It has a battery life of 8 hours, which is usually long enough for the pill to make its way all the way through the small bowel into the colon. It's designed to image, the pill cam is designed to image primarily the stomach and the small bowel as well. And that's what was used in Michelle's case.
Doctor, you mentioned a few words here that I'd like you to explain to the court. You mentioned that when you examined, you did the endoscopy of Michelle, she had some aphthous ulcers.
That's correct.
Can you tell the court what an aphthous ulcer is?
Would now be a good time to show the slides that I prepared. Also, can I ask for a laser pointer?
Just for the record, Dr. Kriegsman, Dr. Poshian is going to be showing some slides. We've got the first one up on the screen, and a paper copy of the slide is going to be filed into the record by the petitioners. Go ahead, Ms. Jim Catherine. Mr. Homer, did you folks give a copy of the slide to the court reporter as well?
No.
Yeah, make sure we do.
Ulcer. I want to first define a few other terms that I've used this afternoon, and that would give us a foundation to understand what an aphthous ulcer is. So, this first slide, the definition of an ulcer in general, and this is from a standard pathology textbook that is widely used in this country in medical schools. I used it when I was in medical school, and this is the definition and the photograph from the electronic version of the textbook. And an ulcer is a local defect of the surface of an organ produced by the shedding of inflammatory necrotic means dead, tissue. Ulceration can occur only when tissue necrosis and the resultant inflammation exist on or near a surface. And I'm going to use the laser pointer to demonstrate on the slide on the screen behind me. This area over here is the lining of the organ. And this hole is the ulcer, so it's kind of punched out and it's a crater. And an ulcer can involve either a shallow ulcer with just the absolute, you know, external lining of the organ, or it can go deeper and penetrate deeper layers, and depending on the organ and what layers are there, an ulcer can extend for various depths. And in the case of the gastrointestinal tract, if the process of ulceration goes deep enough, it can perforate, even go all the way through, and that causes all kinds of horrendous complications. That's an ulcer. And this is a kind of ulcer. The same type of process would be seen in classic acid-related diseases of the stomach, where the erosive entity is stomach acid, and that's causing the erosion and then ulceration. And many drugs can cause this as well. Aspirin, other non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, the reason why they can injure your stomach, which many of us are aware that it does, of course, stomach aches, is because for a variety of reasons, it ends up ulcerating the lining of the stomach. That's what an ulcer is.
Dr. Shih, you had also mentioned the term lymphonodular hyperplasia.
Yeah, let's look at the next slide for that. This is an example of the lymphonodular hyperplasia that we talked about. And on the slide on the left, this is a photograph that I took of a patient. This is the colon. And the colonic mucosa is typically smooth, and here we see the presence of these small little bumps. And can you appreciate that? There's a small little nodules that are present beneath the surface. These are submucosal, they're beneath the mucosal level, and because of their size, they cause a small protrusion. And I don't want to get into the issue now whether this is considered always normal or always abnormal or sometimes normal, sometimes abnormal. I want to avoid that issue for now. I just want to show the picture of what the entity is. This would be the microscopic appearance of lymphoid hyperplasia. And what you see here is this is lymphoid tissue. This is a collection of primarily B lymphocytes, and they're coalescing. They're not encapsulated, they're kind of loosely formed, and they form a nodule. And this mass is what causes the pushing out or the protrusion that you see here that's evident as the nodule. And this lower arrow, it shows another lymphoid nodule here, and the pale portion at the center is called the germinal center. And the germinal center is the area of the lymphoid nodule that's actively replicating. The function of lymphoid nodules, of lymphoid tissue in general, but those of the intestine, is to detect anything that the immune system sees as foreign. Lymphoid nodules are part of the overall immune system of the bowel. It detects anything it sees as foreign, and that could be a virus, it could be a bacteria, it could be a fungus, it could be a food allergen. Whatever comes its way that it sees as a threat, it goes through a series of processes that initially involve the lymphoid nodule. And when it does that, the lymphoid nodule is stimulated to produce and replicate B cells, subpopulation lymphocytes, and those B cells are the area of rapid replication is that germinal center, and this is a normal immune response to any sort of invading pathogen. And when you have those active germinal centers, that would cause even further enlargement of the lymphoid nodule. And the photograph on the left would show even more prominent lymphonodularity, because the underlying lymphoid nodule is now bigger because of the presence of this hyperactive germinal center.
And was it your testimony that you found lymphoid nodular hyperplasia in Michelle's colon?
Yeah, in her colon, it was most prominent in the terminal ileum, which is an area that's most rich in lymphoid tissue. So if you would take a look at the density of lymphoid nodules throughout the bowel, the terminal ileum is the area which is most dense, has the most lymphoid activity, so that when you have lymphoid hyperplasia, when you have an allergic response, when you have a bacterial infection, you would expect that the region of the bowel that most manifests that in terms of lymphoid nodularity would be the terminal ileum.
And doctor, the presence of the lymphoid nodular hyperplasia, would that be an indication that there was some process in Michelle's bowel that was causing the inflammatory bowel disease?
Well, it suggests that the immune system is recognizing something and responding to it appropriately.
And would that something be some sort of infectious agent?
Could be.
Now, doctor, you included on your next three slides definitions of aphthous ulcers.
Okay.
Could you kindly tell the court the reason why you included these definitions?
Yeah. Michelle's finding on her PILCAN study was one of aphthous ulcerations, and I wanted to give the court the definition of an aphthous ulcer. So we know what an ulcer is, we know what lymphoid hyperplasia is. The aphthous ulcer, and this is taken from a standard gastroenterology textbook, and it's also widely used, and it's accepted as authoritative. I'm not aware of anyone that would consider it not to be authoritative. And the definition reads that the earliest characteristic lesion of Crohn's disease is the aphthous ulcer, meaning that Crohn's disease starts off as being an aphthous ulcer. That is the earliest lesion seen in disease, that the horrendous manifestations of Crohn's disease, the deep ulcers, the fissures, the fistulae, the strictures, all begin as an aphthous ulcer. These superficial ulcers are minute. They range in size from barely visible to 3 millimeters, and they're surrounded by a halo of erythema. So this is the endoscopic appearance. The appearance to the clinician who has the scope in the colon is that you see an ulcer, a bit of a depression, and there's a halo of redness, erythema's redness, that surrounds this ulcer. Now in the small intestine, the aphthous ulcers arise most often over lymphoid aggregates. That is a characteristic feature of the aphthous ulcer, is that it occurs specifically over a lymphoid nodule with destruction of the overlying M cells. And the colon, definition continues, the aphthae can occur endoscopically. So the visual appearance in the colon, you may not be able to appreciate ulceration like you can in the small bowel. Even in the colon, they occur over these lymphoepithelial complexes or lymphoid nodules, lymphoid aggregates. Okay, that's the first definition. The second definition, which is the same definition, just from another source, from a standard pathology textbook that will be used for the first slide, and I quote, a characteristic sign of early disease, of early Crohn's disease, is focal mucosal ulcers resembling canker sores, aphthous ulcers, edema, and loss of the normal mucosal texture. With progressive disease, mucosal ulcers coalesce into long serpentine linear ulcers, which tend to be oriented along the axis of the bowel. Narrow fissures develop between the folds of the mucosa. Now that's in bold font, because what I'm going to show you in a few minutes is that Michelle's pill camera demonstrates that not only does she have the appearance of aphthous ulcers on her pill cam study, but there is some excellent quality photographs of the orientation of these ulcers, the linear orientation of these ulcers within the fold of the small bowel. So it fits the definition of the early lesions of Crohn's disease to a T. And again, in more advanced disease that penetrates deeply through the bowel wall. Now, the earliest lesion in Crohn's disease appears to be focal neutrophilic infiltration into the epithelial layer, particularly overlying mucosal lymphoid aggregates. And again, in bold, because that's what we're going to be showing you Michelle had. Third definition, which is identical also. I've just scanned this from... this is a very, very interesting paper published in a journal. This is not from a textbook. But I included it here because this goes back as far as 1980, so this is not new information. This is old information, and this study was landmark in that it demonstrated, it defined and described an aphthous lesion and compared it to electron microscope studies. So it gave you the proved the ultrastructural findings. It went beyond what you see with a regular light microscope, but it correlated it with an even finer ability to see smaller structures. And again, the definition that they go by when they did this work was, if you look at the last sentence, an almost constant feature of these minute lesions is active proliferation. I'm sorry, I'll go back up the second sentence. The lesion is typically located over an aggregate of lymphocytes in the basal portion of propria. Again, same definition. And what this adds, which we didn't see in the two definitions before, was that an almost constant feature of these minute lesions is active proliferation of the epithelium at the ulcer margin, an apparent attempt at healing. That's another characteristic of the aphthous ulceration. That's what this is.
And doctor, do you have a photograph of an aphthous ulcer to show the court?
So the next slide will demonstrate using the same slide I showed you before, obtained from a textbook, of a lymphoid nodule, and I'll use my laser pointer again on the screen behind me. If this is the lymphoid nodule that's causing the protrusion of the overlying epithelium into the lumen of the bowel, the aphthous ulcer would then be ulceration of the mucosal lining that overlies those lymphoid nodules and lymphoid follicles. And that would be a definition of the aphthous ulcer. So when you're looking at an aphthous ulcer, you would like to be able to identify an underlying lymphoid nodule either visually with a good quality photograph or histologically from a tissue specimen under the microscope.
And doctor, you obtain this through what procedure?
Obtain what?
You able to determine that an aphthous ulcer exists through what procedure?
Well, in Michelle's case, the earliest indication of her having aphthous ulcers was on a colonoscopy that that I did in 2003, September of 2003.
Okay, and doctor, a colonoscopy again is what?
Colonoscopy, I have a slide just to demonstrate what that is to make sure that everyone understands. And this is also a classic, just a cartoon of the intestine. The area in pink is the colon. You see the scope entering at the anus and going all the way around the colon. The tip of the scope emits a very bright light using fiber optic technology. What is seen at one end of the scope is transmitted and displayed on a video monitor that the endoscopist looks at, so you see the images in real time. So we did a colonoscopy on Michelle in 2003, and the photograph on your left, I'm sorry, on your right, these two photographs are from the colonoscopy that I did on Michelle in 2003, and what you see here are classic colonoscopy appearances of an aphthous ulcer. So you have a central white area with a surrounding red halo of erythema. Now one could argue, using the definition of there being an underlying lymphoid nodule, how do you know that this is underlying lymphoid nodule? Maybe this is just a regular depressed ulcer, and that's a good question. But other photographs here suggest, this one in particular, suggest that there's a protrusion into the bowel lumen and surrounding erythema. There's another one over here. This is the central area with ulceration. Now again, you really can't appreciate the ulceration from these photographs. The colonoscope generally does not have the resolution to allow you to see very small epithelial ulceration. Sometimes you can see it, but very often you can't. And in these photographs, there's no clear evidence from these photographs that there is an ulceration going on, but there is clearly a nodule with surrounding erythema. And these I call aphthous ulcers, and there were four of them. And on the photo on the left, you see a photograph that was obtained by Dr. Ursea in 2006 of Michelle's colon, and you see again the central either nodule or ulcer, it's hard to tell from this photo, with surrounding erythema. The redness, I want to point out also that when you look at these photos, when you have erythema around these inflamed ulcers / nodules, when you have that, the erythema does not tend to have a sharply demarcated border. This kind of fades out and dissipates as it moves further away from that central lesion. And that would be distinct from an ulcer, which you would expect to demonstrate a very sharply demarcated border. And I make this point now because the PILCAM photos will show a sharply demarcated border. And that's how I know that what the PILCAM is showing in the small bowel is an ulcer, which is really not appreciated in these photos.
Doctor, you mentioned a PILCAM. Again, what is a PILCAM?
So the PILCAM is demonstrated in this slide. The photograph on the left is a close-up view of it, manufactured by Given Imaging in Yokneam, Israel. And it's a capsule with a clear dome lens, and those four white rectangles on top are the light source. They flash twice per second. They take a photograph. The The black circle between them is the photographic lens. And just to give you an idea of the size and the perspective on that, is a photograph of somebody holding it between their fingers.
And Doctor, who performed the pill cam in Michelle?
The pill cam was done in 2006 by Dr. Arcea at the same time that she performed an upper endoscopy and colonoscopy. So at that colonoscopy, there was this apparent actus ulcer seen in her colon.
And did you have an opportunity to review this pill cam yourself?
And yes, I reviewed it way back when, soon after it was performed. And we'll discuss that in just a few moments.
Are these photos of Michelle's pill cam that was done by Dr. Arcea?
Now, this slide is just to give the court an idea about what a pill cam photo would look like of an aphthous ulcer. These photos were taken off the Given Imaging online atlas. They provide gastroenterologists with online photographs that are demonstrative to help us clinically. And these are downloaded from the website. And three photos of examples, the atlas labels it as aphthous ulcers and Crohn's disease. And you see here, again, that central pale lesion, the surrounding halo of erythema or redness. Same thing you see over here, the central lesion. Hard to tell from these photos if there's a depressed ulcer there or if it's projecting in the lumen. Surrounding erythema, and same thing over here, the central lesion with surrounding erythema. The next slide shows what Michelle's pill cam photo show, and you will notice how identical these lesions are to the lesions that the atlas identifies as aphthous lesions of Crohn's disease, central lesion surrounding erythema here as well. Blue arrows are pointing to the lesions that are of interest to us. The upper left in each frame tells you time that's elapsed since the beginning of the study. So we see that this is multiple locations. This is 3 hours and 16 minutes. This is a minute later. This is over 2 hours later, giving you the idea that these aphthous lesions are scattered throughout rather small bowel.
And
yeah, go ahead.
Doctor, so the slides that you have up here, the photographs that you have up, this is the passage of the pill cam through her small bowel. Is that
right?
It? And
right.
How rapidly does this passage take?
It depends on a number of factors. Mostly on the motility of the bowel. The way the bowel works, it has what's called peristalsis, so it propels things forward from top to bottom by a series of sequential contractions of the smooth muscle of the bowel wall. There are many disease states that affect the peristalsis of the bowel. Some disease states make the transit time quicker, so things move through very rapidly. Other disease states affect it the other way. They make transit time slower, and it could take many, many hours to pass through the bowel.
And in Michelle's case, there was a passage of almost 2 hours between the initial findings of aphthous ulcers and the later finding?
More than that, because her initial findings were very early on. We'll show some more slides coming up. This is another example of the central nodular lesion. And here, you get the sense that there's erosion. There's more of a sharply demarcated border. This is different from the photographs of erythema that we saw in the pictures obtained at colonoscopy that didn't have that sharp demarcated border. These have a distinct impression of a sharply demarcated border of an erosion.
You indicated that this is a picture of the colon.
This is a small bowel. The photos before that we showed, the first photo of the aphthous ulcer of the colon, what I meant to say was that surrounding rim of erythema did not have a sharply demarcated border. So in dealing with erythema or redness, you don't expect to see a sharply demarcated border, but when you deal with an ulceration, you do expect to see a sharply demarcated border, which is what this photograph shows, and there are even better examples in the slides to come. These are all examples taken from Michelle's Pulkan study. And I want you to look at the black arrow. The black arrow is the four photographs, 1, 2, 3, and 4, are sequential. So they're taken over a period of 2 seconds. Again, it's one photograph per every half second. And what you're seeing over here is, again, the central area of this appears clearly to be a raised nodule with surrounding, again, area of erythema and erosion that is around it. And what's interesting is that in these photographs, if you remember the photograph of the Pulkan that we showed at the beginning, the lens of the Pulkan is a dome. And as the camera is traveling through the bowel, the bowel mucosa is pressed up against the lens. That's one way, that's one type of photograph that the camera can take. So you have the mucosa of the bowel pressed up against the lens and you're photographing it. Another way that the camera could photograph the mucosa is if the camera is sitting within an open lumen. So it's photographing, like taking a picture of a hallway. And we'll show some photos what Michelle's bowel is like over there. And these particular photos, what we're looking at, is the bowel mucosa is pressed up against the lens. And the way we know that is because this area, the central area of the photograph, is a bit lighter color than the surrounding area. And that's because it gets pressed up against it and it's pushing out the blood. And it has this cavernous, a circular appearance, and this mucosa here is clearly different. It's pinker, it's lighter than the area around it. And I mention this because when you have an erosion, when you have an erosion, it's 1 millimeter, and you have the mucosa pressed up against the lens of the capsule, you'd expect that erosion area would not be pressed up against it as well, but it's a bit off the lens. And that's appreciated in these photos, and that's why you're able to see it so clearly. Even though the mucosa is up against the lens, there's still a depression with a sharply demarcated border. This gives you, again, a sequence of four photos that shows the appearance of that particular lesion as the camera is moving slowly by it.
All right, just for the record, that was page 13 of the sequence of Dr. Kriegsman's slides. Go ahead, Mr. Jim Kaplan.
And Dr. Kriegsman, what does the next slide show?
This is, again, a very similar type picture. You have the mucosa pressed up against the lens of the camera. And what you see here, which is this is demonstrated even better than the previous photos, is you have one nodule there, another one there, another one there. So here we begin to see the pattern that we referred to before in the definition of the earliest lesions of Crohn's disease. We have this aphthous ulcer with surrounding erythema redness, the sharply demarcated border, and the presence of this lymphoid nodule within it, three lymphoid nodules.
And Doctor, the next slide, how does that differ from the other ones that you showed us previously?
This slide is different because this is a photograph of that same lesion taken through air. So here, although the periphery of the photograph shows the mucosa pressed up against the lens of the Pulkan, the center of the Pulkan is photographing the lumen, or taking a picture down the hallway. And what you can see very clearly here, and these are very impressive, is this distinct nodule. This does not have the appearance of an ulcer at all. This clearly is a protruding nodule. And there's, again, the sharply demarcated area of erythema around it. The same things are back over here in the back of the photograph, and these lesions are contained linearly, again, along the fold of the small bowel.
And, Doctor, the next slide is a slide of what?
It's again viewed through air, and it's just really the same as the previous slide, just another location.
And
again, the sharply demarcated border.
And Doctor, this slide shows that this is 4 hours and 34 seconds after Michelle had swallowed the PillCam.
Well, she didn't actually swallow it. It was placed endoscopically. It was done during the endoscopy, so a device called a Roth-net was attached to the endoscope, and the pill camera was deployed in the proximal duodenum using the Roth-net. But
so
it was from the time the capsule was activated, this is 4 hours later.
Okay. So you've showed us photos from approximately on page 15. That first PillCam photo indicates 20 minutes.
Can you say that again, Ms. Chin Kaplan?
I was saying on page 15, does the time...
This one's 20 minutes and 51 seconds.
So this was 20 minutes and 51 seconds after the PillCam had been placed by Dr. Osea?
Correct.
And Doctor, the next photo was 4 hours and 34 seconds after the placement of the PillCam?
4 hours, 34 minutes and 1 second.
Okay. And is that an indication that in that period of time, this PillCam is taking photos of the lymphoid nodule hyperplasia that you have described throughout her colon?
Well, not just the LNH, but also these aphthous ulcerations, right? And I should add that these photos are by no means all of the lesions. Bowel had contained dozens and dozens of these lesions.
Were there some additional photos that you wanted to show this court?
Yes. This one also demonstrates, again, the mucosa is pressed up against the lens of the capsule, and the lumen is actually down this way. But this area clearly is unable to be pressed up against the lens of the capsule because they're contained over there, small erosion, central lymphoid nodule, surrounding erythema, sharp demarcation of the border. And throughout this whole area, you can see a whole bunch of those small nodules there with surrounding erythema, again, lined up in folds along the fold of the small bowel. And you can even see it through here as well.
And that was slide 17. Ms. Shun Kaplan, if you mention that you're going to the next slide, if you give the page number, that will make a little better record on this.
Okay. And Dr. Kriesman, we're moving on to page 18 now.
Okay, this slide on the left, taken 31 minutes and 54 seconds after activation of the capsule, shows again more of the same. It's the tissue of the bowel mucosa pressed up against the lens of the capsule, and you have a central nodule over there surrounding erythema. Sharply demarcated border, and what's interesting about this photograph is that, as you recall, third definition that we gave of aphthous ulcer included the finding of this heaping up at the rim of the ulcer as an indication of the aphthous ulcer entity, and that's the theory was that the attempt at healing and that epithelial regeneration, and that you can see, you can appreciate this thickening around the rim, and you can see it over here also. But this is, in my mind, this is a more impressive picture. And here you certainly see again this in an area where the tissue is otherwise pressed up against the lens of the capsule. This area is not; it's in the central nodule surrounding erythema.
And Doctor, on page 19 of this PillCam.
Okay. And this photograph. These two show more of the same, and here you see again it's just the same central nodules surrounding erythema, heaped up rim, and it's pushed off the lens of the scope. And the reason why I'm repeating these photos, it may seem repetitive, but the point I want to make is that these were present throughout Michelle's bowel, not just in one or two locations. I don't want to show all of them on the table there.
Doctor, if we just briefly run through the next few PillCam slides, could you just point out?
I think it's the last slide, and maybe it's the next to the last one. And this is a very nice demonstration of the linear aspect of these lesions. You see in here, central nodule, erythema around it, sharply demarcated border, and you see it again over here as well. Nodule, erythema, nodule, along the fold of the small bowel, exactly as described to be the earliest lesion of Crohn's disease.
So that was slide 20. Go ahead.
And slide 21, Doctor?
This is the last, I believe, of Michelle's pill cam photos, which shows more of the same, taken at 44 minutes, 29 seconds, and shows where the three black arrows are, three distinct lymphoid nodules surrounding erythema, and mucosal ulceration within the fold of the small bowel. Exactly as described.
And Doctor, the photos that you took on pages 22 through 24, can you describe to the court what the significance of these photos are?
Yes, this photo I've forgotten about. I include this to demonstrate.
Which one are you talking about?
This is a photograph taken at 1 hour, 42 minutes, and 13 seconds.
Okay, page 22. Go ahead.
What the black arrows are, again, pointing to the rim of this ulcer, the small mucosal ulceration. And if you look, you see, of course, the central nodule that is evident over here. But the area around it is not homogeneous. It's actually heterogeneous. These areas are darker than the surrounding areas, even though they're all within the rim of the ulcer. And what this suggests is that the ulcer is varying in depths. And I thought that was just something that's illustrated. I wanted to include that.
And what is present on page 23?
This is a demonstration of an ulcer without erythema, which I found very interesting. These photographs show, again, the same pattern of mucosa standing away from the lens of the capsule, despite it, everything else being pushed up against it around it. And within that area that's off of the lens, you have those lymphoid nodules that are there, and you see a very sharply demarcated border, but you don't really appreciate the presence of redness or inflammation, and I wanted to include that as something that was, I thought was interesting as well. And this is more of the same. We're taking a look at slides now, taken 31 minutes and 46 seconds. These are two sequential photos, again, central lymphoid nodules surrounding erosion with really minimal erythema or inflammation.
Doctor, what is page 25 a picture of?
Page 25, for those of you who don't know what this is a photograph of Michelle's diaper and her diarrhea. And I included this slide. This is as recently as July of 06. I included this slide because I thought it was important for the court to see firsthand what the diarrhea was. When we're talking about liquidy stool, if there's any question in anyone's mind whether this diarrhea was real or not real or semi-soft or otherwise other various degrees of being formed, this is Michelle's typical stool. To be any more formed than this is unusual for her and is almost always a result of being on either prednisone or 6-MP or Remicade or now Humira.
And Doctor, you indicated that Michelle had also had arthritis. Is this a picture of what you saw when you first saw Michelle? And this is page 26.
I don't recall when this was taken. But at some point, clearly, this is Michelle, taken by Teresa, sent to me by mail, and it shows actually both ankles are swollen, but there's clear asymmetry between the left leg and the right leg. And Teresa had mentioned earlier in her testimony that the swelling had gone all the way up to the knee, and this is a photo demonstration of exactly that. The ankle is deformed, it's swollen, the foot is turned out. And the swelling does indeed extend up to the knee.
Doctor, on page 27, what was the reason for including this photo?
I included this photo to show you what Michelle looked like right before I saw her. This is at around the time she was hospitalized in July, August of 2003. And one of the things that resulted in that hospitalization from the investigations was the diagnosis of vitamin K deficiency. and vitamin K is needed for clotting. And it was when Teresa had called me before the hospitalization, saying that Michelle, who was self-abusive when she's in pain, which always improves when diarrhea and arthritis improves. During this period, when things were really bad, she was self-abusive, but she was causing severe black and blue marks or ecchymoses. And this is a photograph of that. And the reason why they were more severe than usual was, A, her pain was worse, so she probably was hitting herself harder. But more importantly, she had a clotting disorder that was diagnosed in the hospital from vitamin K deficiency, which is a result of malnutrition because of her severe anorexia and inability to tolerate anything by mouth. She became deficient in vitamin K, and when she was banged, it tended to bruise more than it normally would have.
Doctor, with the history that you took, the physical exam that you conducted, the information that you obtained from Mrs. Cedillo about Michelle's early years, your laboratory findings, and the endoscopic procedure that you performed, did you come to a conclusion about whether or not Michelle Cedillo suffered from an enteral colitis?
No. In my mind, there was no doubt, even going back to 2003, that she had an enterocolitis of some sort. In my mind, I was calling it an indeterminate colitis at that point. After looking at the Pilkington study of 2006, I have no hesitation in labeling this as Crohn's disease based upon the characteristic features of those aphthous lesions. Within the small bowel, as just described in the series of slides that we saw, it's not just the presence of those lesions. The aphthous lesions of the bowel in isolation, even if they have the characteristic features described as early Crohn's disease, that if that was the only finding, I would be hesitant to label it as Crohn's disease. But when you have those dramatic photos in the presence of a history of diarrhea and abdominal pain, in the presence of a physical exam that shows extra-intestinal manifestations of arthritis, uveitis, and iritis with marked irritability and self-abusive behaviors, when you have growth data, when she was at her worst, when she had the worst flare of her bowel issues and her arthritis that coincided with a 20-pound weight loss over 6 months, coinciding with laboratory findings of thrombocytosis, an elevated OMC, which is, as you recall, is highly specific. It's a 95% specificity for Crohn's disease. An elevated ESR, an elevated C-reactive protein, and the presence of two colonoscopies done 3 years apart by two different endoscopists showing aphthous ulcerations of the colon in different areas of the colon, in the presence of a PILCAM study showing widespread aphthous ulcerations in the characteristic pattern that you would expect based upon all previous descriptions of Crohn's disease, and in the presence of aphthous ulcerations, which all agree are the earliest sign of Crohn's disease, meaning whether every aphthous ulceration is Crohn's disease, the answer is no. Every aphthous ulcer is not Crohn's disease, but all bowel lesions of Crohn's disease do begin as aphthous lesions. So when you have all of this taken together, and in addition to that, what's not on the slide is her clinical response to anti-inflammatories and immunosuppressants, the predicted response of improvement in all of her organs that are inflamed to anti-inflammatories, to prednisone, to sulfasalazine, to 6-MP, to Remicade, and now to Humira. All those together form an undeniable diagnosis of Crohn's disease.
Doctor, at some point in time, did you become aware that Michelle had a bowel biopsy done earlier by Dr. Montes?
Yes.
And did you at some time become aware that that gut biopsy result returned with measles RNA in the biopsy sample?
Yes.
Do you know approximately when you learned that information?
I don't remember when Teresa mentioned it to me.
And at some point in time, did you come to a conclusion that there was a relationship between the presence of the measles virus that was measles RNA that was found in the gut biopsy done in 2002 and the enterocolitis that Michelle suffered?
So I was very interested in that because once I realized that these children do in fact have bowel disease and that this is going on in so many of the kids with autism and GI symptoms, because of the reports. Because of the reports or clinical association or observed association, I should say, by so many parents that this the onset of their bowel disease and their autism occurred shortly after MMR, so it's a reasonable question to say, is there in fact an association? So that question did interest me, and in fact, we have an IRB-approved study to look exactly at that, among other issues of bowel disease. But one of the features of the bowels that we're looking at is to see whether we can find any evidence of measles RNA. And personally, I didn't want to believe it until the specimens that I took and I processed and I preserved and I sent, done by a lab personnel that I'm familiar with. If we could find that, then I would be very much convinced of that. So we embarked on this project in 2003, end of 2003, we presented our preliminary findings at the IMFAR conference. IMFAR is the acronym for International Meeting for Autism Research, in June of 2006, exactly a year ago, and it was held in Montreal. And we had a poster at that meeting, we meaning myself and Steve Walker from Wake Forest University and Karen Heppner and Jeff Siegel. And on that poster, we demonstrated, we displayed, I should say, the our findings, our preliminary findings of measles virus in the biopsies that I had obtained from the terminal ileum of a number of our patients with autism and bowel disease.
You indicated that you presented this information at IMFAR.
That's correct.
What is IMFAR?
IMFAR is the International Meeting for Autism Research. It's a very prestigious annual meeting where researchers from all around the world gather to present the abstracts and sometimes even longer speaking presentations of their findings. It incorporates medical issues of autism, behavioral issues of autism, diagnostic issues, psychiatric issues. It's just a very comprehensive meeting.
Doctor, you indicated that you presented this information on a poster.
That's correct.
Is it literally a poster on an easel?
So it's exactly what you imagine. It's a big poster on an easel, yeah.
Special Minister, could I just approach the witness for a minute? Special Master, we're going to be passing around a document which is the poster that was presented at this meeting.
Mm-hmm. I take it this is not something that's already in the record.
No, Special Master.
And why wasn't this particular document already in the record? This was
The abstract is in the record. This is what was posted, I guess, outside
right.
The door.
The extract is in the record where?
The abstract is contained in Dr. Kriegsman exhibit number. If you give me a moment, I'll tell you exactly
okay.
what. Tab K, I was told.
I'm sorry, Tab K.
K.
All right. Thank you.
Would this perhaps be a good time to just break the afternoon so I can locate my own file?
All right, let's take our 15-minute break for the afternoon right now. Yeah. Before we take our break, all right.
We were planning to take a brief break between Dr. Kriegsman's testimony and the beginning of class, particularly in light of the fact that
okay. Well, if you'll need another break, where do you stand right here? Why do we need a break right now?
Just to locate the abstract, I can tell the court where it is.
I've got it.
Oh,
I've got
okay.
it in front of me.
Okay.
It's a tab. You said tab K.
Okay. We can continue.
Okay. For the record, this is tab K, I think, to Dr. Kriegsman's, which is, was that exhibit 59? 59, thank you. Yeah, Ms. Chin-Kaplan, to get a handle on this stuff that's being produced at trial here, let's try to do that right now. You filed a group of exhibits that were the copies of Dr. Aposhian's slides yesterday. Well, you didn't file it, but you gave us copies. And I want you to file that. Let's call that... Petitioner's Trial Exhibit 1.
Dr. Potion.
And then the one that we just went through of Dr. Kriegsman, let's call that Petitioner's Trial Exhibit 2. And then the document you just gave us now.
We can call that 2A?
Well, let's go number three. Let's just go number three. To keep our. Well, actually, there was something else filed. They just called to my attention, which was the calendar. You're going to file that afterward. Let's call the calendar Trial Exhibit 4 then. So this one you just gave us will be Trial Exhibit Number 3. And why don't we number our the pages of this particular document aren't numbered, so let's number them as we go through. Go ahead, Ms. Chinkamp.
Thank you, Special Master. You indicated that this was a poster presentation.
Correct.
And on the poster presentation, what does a poster presentation do? What is it for?
Well, it's presented at a conference, and the intention of these conferences are for researchers to share what they've learned with their colleagues, because no one can know everything about everything. So there tend to be lined up, and people that attend the conference walk around from poster to poster, and they read the data. It's an abstract form, meaning that you don't have lengthy descriptions of methodology or technique. It's preliminary, and it's understood to be preliminary. This is not a peer-reviewed presentation by any means. It has to be accepted by the organizers of the conference, so it does pass some sort of elementary screening test, but certainly it's not considered peer reviewed. And typically there are specific hours where one or more of the researchers are physically present at their poster to answer questions that people passing by may have when they read it.
So it's would it be fair to call it a snapshot of your presentation?
I would say it's snapshots of preliminary data.
Fair enough. And Doctor, in this handout which has been labeled as Creedsman Trial Exhibit 3, do you have a copy?
Oh, no, I haven't got a copy.
Doctor, I'm just going to ask you to run very briefly through this poster presentation. This is Creedsman Exhibit, Trial Exhibit Number 3. In the introduction, what information were you relaying to the participant?
Just a bit of a background that autism is very common, the frequency has been increasing over the years. There is a gastrointestinal involvement that's been published and documented, and that there's a previous publication that that found the presence of measles virus RNA within the inflamed intestinal tissue. And we make the point that that's only one publication. No one to date has ever tried to replicate that that information from that particular source, specimen source. We attempted to do so.
And
that's the first page.
And Doctor, what does this second page represent?
The second page are a variety of photographs. Photograph A is a child leaning against a table, which we have come to learn in our experience. These children with autism and bowel symptoms, meaning diarrhea, or having abdominal pain, what they tend to do in an effort to make their bellies feel better is to apply pressure on the lower abdomen, sometimes upper, but usually lower abdomen, and they assume all sorts of interesting positions and spend a good deal of their time doing that. And photograph A is an example of that. Photograph B is a little girl laying on a floor, pressing her hands on her lower abdomen. This is on the left, this is figure one. Figure one has four photographs labeled A through D. We just reviewed A and B. Photograph C of figure one is a photograph of this marked abdominal distension that so many of the children with autism and bowel symptoms have as an accompanying finding to their diarrhea and their pain. And photograph D in figure one is another example of the abdominal distension in a child who clearly is very thin, very thin. In figure two, photograph A is a photograph of endoscopy that I've done with a patient with typical lymphonodular hyperplasia, demonstrating the excessive nature of the lymphoid nodularity and the magnitude of it. Photograph B, in black and white, you really can't appreciate it. Photograph B is a photograph of numerous aphthous ulcerations of the colon, very similar to the aphthous lesions that you've seen just a moment ago on the PILCAN study. Photograph C of figure two demonstrates a typical biopsy or microscopic appearance of the colon that's inflamed, it's colitis, and it shows a lymphocytic infiltration of the mucosa, submucosa, with something called crypt branching. The very center of photograph C, you see a crypt that branches off and forks into two. And crypt branching is an undisputed histologic or histopathologic hallmark of chronic and ongoing inflammation. And this biopsy is typical of biopsies that we see in this group of children. And photograph D of figure two are the photos, the PILCAM photos, or similar photos that you've just seen. These photos were the two photographs taken at PILCAM, and photograph D of figure two were taken by Dr. Federico Balzola in Turin, Italy, on his patients, and he's described PILCAM findings also showing aphthous ulcerations of the small bowel and presented it. I believe it's in as a letter. It's been published in one of the gastroenterology journals in letter form. That's photograph D.
And doctor, on page three.
I'll just read it. This is the objectives. It's a section labeled objectives of the poster. Quote: the primary objective of the study was to determine whether measles virus RNA could be identified in total RNA extracted from ileal tissue of children with chronic GI symptoms, autistic enterocolitis, and regressive autism, and to compare this to neurotypical controls. An additional objective was to determine whether the measles virus sequence generated from RT-PCR products corresponded to the wild type form or a vaccine strain specific form of the virus. Unquote.
And on page four, what is that?
Page four is the brief description of the materials and methods. Would you like me to read it?
Certainly.
Materials and methods. Patients who had a diagnosis of ASD and who were referred to a pediatric gastroenterologist, myself, for evaluation of chronic gastrointestinal symptoms, were eligible to participate in this IRB-approved study. For each patient, medical histories, vaccination records, histopathology reports, and ileocolonoscopy biopsy tissue were available for evaluation. Gastrointestinal symptoms consisted of abdominal pain, diarrhea, constipation, abdominal distension, and growth failure. Representative endoscopic gross pathologic findings included marked lymphonodular hyperplasia and aphthous ulcerations. Representative histopathology is shown above, and consisted of a mild patchy, nonspecific inflammatory infiltrate of the mucosal layer. Findings at wireless capsule endoscopy of the small bowel revealed similar aphthoid lesions. Biopsies of the lymphonodular tissue were tested for the presence of measles virus by RT and PCR.
To the right of this page is figure 3. What is that?
Figure 3 was just a little schematic showing in schematic form what we did. The first photograph shows a cartoon of the intestine with an arrow pointing downwards towards a photograph of two small vials indicating that the biopsy was taken from the terminal ileum and placed in those small vials of RNA later, which is an RNA preservative. And then there's another arrow pointing down to RNA extraction. So the RNA was extracted from the specimens contained in those vials. RT then PCR was done on the specimens after the RNA extraction, and then another arrow going down to sequencing, indicating that on a number of specimens we performed sequencing. I should mention also, since mentioning sequencing, is that at the time of presentation of this abstract, we had not yet performed all the assays on all the specimens or attempted to sequence them. So we reported the findings that we have, which is part of why this is preliminary. So whatever findings we have and what we'll be discussing in a moment don't reflect the fact that we tested all the specimens using a number of different primers and came up with those results. That's not what it indicates.
So this was a partial report of
this
what
partial,
you had
to... It's quite preliminary.
And Doctor, what is page 5?
Page 5 are two photographs of panels of gel and the PCR technology, which Dr. Heppner and Dr. Kennedy will speak about in greater detail tomorrow. These are photographs of the PCR products.
And Dr. Page 6, what is that page 6?
And this is a detailed base pair sequences of the Edmonston vaccine virus. And again, Dr. Heppner and Dr. Kennedy would be able to elucidate more on the details of figure 5.
And Doctor, what is page 7?
A description of the primers that we used, and again, I would defer the description of this to Dr. Heppner and Dr. Kennedy.
And on page 8, Doctor?
Page 8 is a summary of the results, showing the results of initial PCR. PCR runs using 5 different primer strategies. Whether they were positive or negative, and what percentage were positive, and how many, both numerators and denominators, of specimens that were tested using particular primer strategies, and how many of those tested using that particular primer strategy were positive or negative for either PCR, measles virus sequencing, meaning sequencing of measles virus that would not be specific for vaccine strain, but it could be either vaccine or wild type measles. And then lastly, they had designed a primer that would look specifically for the base pair sequence of a vaccine strain, measles virus, and that last row, lightly shaded, shows how many of the specimens were positive as of the date of this poster presentation for vaccine strain specific measles virus.
And these were your preliminary findings?
Correct.
And this was on a poster for anybody to see as they walked into the meeting?
Correct.
And Doctor, you indicate that you were the endoscopist doing this work?
Right. My role in this was, as the gastroenterologist, was to identify the patients who met the clinical criteria for an indication for a diagnostic colonoscopy, in whom there was a strong suspicion based upon their presenting symptoms, their GI symptoms of diarrhea and pain. that an inflammatory lesion is present. Those were the patients who were colonoscope biopsied and entered into the data shown on this poster.
And doctor, your preliminary findings revealed what?
The preliminary findings, as far as the presence of measles virus, and again, I'm not going to give a percentage because that would suggest that we tested all of them and X percent were positive or negative. But all we could say, all that we could say at the time of this poster, is that as far as vaccine strain specific sequencing positivity, a total of six specimens that were positive for vaccine strain specific RNA, the RNA gene. So genetic material that was specific for vaccine strain measles virus is positive in six. And I can't give you a denominator out of how many that was, because again, some were tested just using one strategy, some were tested using multiple strategies. And again, Dr. Kennedy and Dr. Heppner actually would be able to shed more light on that. We also found that if you, putting aside the issue of vaccine strain specificity, if you just looked at how many were positive on base pair sequencing for measles virus, that could either be vaccine or wild type, there was a total of 35. Yeah, 35 specimens were positive for with sequencing of the base pairs for measles virus.
Doctor, based on your education, training, and experience, your treatment of Michelle Cedillo, the history, the findings that you saw on her diagnostic procedures, the laboratory findings that you obtained in the care and treatment of her, the treatment regimen that you ordered for her, as well as her response to that treatment regimen, and your conversations with her subsequent treating doctors, do you have an opinion, more probably than not, whether Michelle's enterocolitis was caused by measles virus?
In my opinion, in all likelihood, the measles virus genome that we're finding in the ileal specimens of these patients is the cause of the bowel inflammation that they have. And in all likelihood, in Michelle's case as well, the finding of measles virus genome in the inflamed or abnormal enterocolitic bowel that we know she has, in all likelihood, that inflammation is a result, in my opinion, of the presence of the measles virus genome.
And could you tell the court the basis for that opinion, the facts that you relied upon when you formulated that opinion?
It's basically it's spelled out in my report, and it's that the based upon the previous publication by the group in Dublin, Ireland, of the presence of measles virus genome in the inflamed guts of autistic children who had bowel symptoms identical to the population that we're looking at here in this poster presentation. That's based upon that combination of factors, the same patients, the same presentation, the same bowel findings, and the same findings of measles virus genome. The likelihood that this genome is causing what appears to be what's consistent with viral inflammation. The pattern of inflammation that we're seeing in these children that's been published and that we've seen in our large series of children is consistent with the viral infection. So the pattern of nonspecific, patchy, mild, chronic active inflammation with lymphoid hyperplasia is something that you'd expect to see with a viral infection. And so all these factors taken together make me think that in all likelihood the inflammation that we're seeing in the bowel and the enterocolitis is a result of the presence of the virus in the bowel.
Thank you, Doctor.
All right. Let's take our 15-minute break at this point. Mr. Manosky, is that good? Did you have a point?
That'd be fine, sir.
Okay. All right. To the folks at home, I apologize. We did not take our break earlier. We are taking a 15-minute break now at 3:12. We'll start again at about 3:27.